Drenched, and we're off on the weekly tour of sports and pop culture. The Bobcast, episode 3 is here. It's Friday afternoon, and you know what that means. We got a great show in store for you. The NBA draft kept me up late last night. It made me very angry, as you could imagine if you follow me on Twitter. I'm your host, Bobby Manning, at RealBobManning on Twitter. It's June 24th, 2016, and this is a show I've been really excited about for a long time. But first, NBA draft, we have to hit on it. It was just one of the most intriguing nights of all time, aside from the obvious Celtics element, which is going to have me a little salty for the rest of the summer. There were some really intriguing developments, and even though the TD Garden might be surrounded by pitchforks and angry fans donning green this afternoon, there's a lot of happy teams out there, there's a lot of happy prospects around the world, and that's a key factor. So we'll return to the NBA draft a little bit later, but this is going to be a baseball show. We're going to take our eyes off basketball for a little bit. We hit on basketball a lot last week with Snotty Drippin, and that reminds me, please, if you would be so kind, follow the show on Twitter at The Bobcast Show and give us a rate and subscribe on iTunes. I told everyone if you gave us a rating, left your name, I'd shout you out on the air. I'm going to follow through on my promise. Bradley Gonzalez, a good friend of mine, gave a nice review. And if you do, we'll shout you out on the next week's show. And who knows, there might even be wink, wink, nod, nod, Bobcast t-shirts down the line. So if you leave a rating and a review on iTunes, you might have one of those coming your way. Who knows? So the Celtics came away with 6 players from the draft. Jaylen Brown, Gershon Yabusele, Ante Zizek, Demetrius Jackson, Ben Bentel, and Abdel Nader. If you haven't noticed, I've been practicing some of those pronunciations. But we'll push that to the back burner. Baseball season's in full swing here in June. And as always, there's been a bounty of interesting developments. The Rangers are absolutely running away with the American League West by 10 games. The Cleveland Indians, in the wake of the Cleveland Cavaliers championship, have a nice strong hold on the Central. But the Royals and some of the other teams out there, Detroit, are lurking. And an MLB draft just passed through, and a ton of high school, very, very young prospects came off the board, adding to the sort of youth movement we've seen in baseball over pretty much the past decade, especially the past 5 years, I'd say. And then in the National League, some powerhouses emerging between the Nationals, Cubs, Giants. Largely youth-driven. I mean, baseball, back in the 90s, back decades ago, free agency ruled the game. I think you're seeing a transition, and it's not very quiet anymore. A lot of people have realized it, but good drafting is the emphasis for baseball success now. And to talk about the baseball landscape, we have a sensational guest with us today. One of my favorite people to interact with on Twitter. I'd call him a baseball extraordinaire. I don't know what he wants you to call him. But Devin Fink of CoverThoseBases.com is with us today. I'm so excited for him. A little introduction. You can find him at Devin Fink on Twitter. CoverThoseBases.com, like I said. But when Billy Butler signed with the Athletics back in 2014, away from the Royals, fan favorite on Kansas City, did the home run derby, great player there for a number of years. It wasn't Kevin Rosenthal, it wasn't an Athletics beat writer even, and it wasn't Tim Kirch and any of those guys in the national media. It was Devin Fink, and I've gotten a lot of credit over the years for some of the work I've done in sports media at a young age. This guy, since 11 years old, he's been running his own website. He's been reporting on baseball, doing interviews. He started a joint venture with Robert Murray, and that's where he actually broke the Billy Butler signing with the Oakland Athletics back in 2014. He got his moment in the spotlight, appearing on MLB Network, and he's been at it ever since. Just an incredible sight. If you've never been there, you have to visit one day. He aspires to become a baseball reporter professionally one day, and I don't think there's any doubt he's going to do it. He's already well on his way. 4,000 followers on Twitter. You should add to that at Devin Fink, like I said before. And we're going to bring him in right now, ready to take on high school next year. Imagine that. Devin Fink has joined the weekly tour. Welcome aboard, Devin.
Hey, Bobby, how are you? Just one thing. I'm not sure where you got this, but I'm going into 10th grade next year, Bobby.
10th grade, high school nevertheless. Got to check my sources. I know Devin checks his sources. So I got to ask you, Devin, right off the bat, what influenced you to get in the media at such an absurdly young age? I mean, I had interest in sports and media way back when I was your age, but I didn't take action on it until I got into high school myself. What pushed you to get into it at the middle school age?
Well, I mean, it goes back to my love of baseball, which I really feel like started when the Phillies won the World Series in 2008. I think that was a big turning point. A lot of my family's from Philadelphia, and my grandfather had loved the game, you know, his entire life. And from that moment, you know, all those good Phillies teams, my grandfather and I, we'd talk about baseball. We'd go to games together in Philadelphia watching the Phillies and cheering them on. And unfortunately, you know, he passed away in 2012. And I was really sad. I didn't really know how to keep talking to him. You know, my mom bought me a journal to try and express my thoughts to him. But I really just wanted to talk baseball with him, and that's kind of how I started my own blog. I was just really sharing my thoughts about what was going on around the game, whether it was news or my opinion or things like that, and that's just kind of how it started, and it branched off into this, and I really have no idea still how I got here.
That's a very touching story, Devin, and you said you talked a lot about your grandfather. Who were some of the baseball players he watched back when he was a young fan, and did he tell you about any of the guys you never got to see before you were alive?
Yeah, he basically told me the entire Phillies history. I mean, he was like my own personal Vince Scully, I guess you could say, for the Phillies. I mean, he watched Richie Ashburn play. He watched the Whiz Kids. He came up. He watched, you know, the 1980 World Series team, the 1993 World Series team. He had it all. He had all the stories watching those guys play. When Roy Halladay threw his perfect game, he always talked to me about Jim Bunning's perfect game and how he remembers watching that game, listening to the game on the radio, in his back pocket, things like that that you could just never get from anyone else.
It's an incredible story, and you got to feel good, even though it's a shame that he passed away, that you got to see that last Phillies championship in 2008. Did you get to see the team in first person with him that year?
Yeah, I did. And especially, you know, the Phillies stayed good for another couple of years, too. And so those were some fun years. 2009, they were back in the World Series, and we got to watch those games at my house together. In 2010, I think that was the year they won 102 games, and that was another fun year. And unfortunately, they didn't have the same playoff success, but we were able to cherish a lot of the good Phillies teams together.
Me being a Red Sox fan myself, I absolutely loved that Phillies core back then between Placido Polanco, Ryan Howard, Carlos Ruiz. One of my favorite players of my lifetime even is Shane Victorino, who got to win a World Series here in Boston. So, you know, those were some really fun teams. And moving forward a little bit, at what moment did you decide to start transitioning from just writing about baseball to actually reporting on it with interviews and the breaking news we're going to get to eventually? But it's really interesting how you've grown the site throughout the years.
I think that was a lot had to do with Twitter, honestly. I think Twitter's really helped me reach out not only to the guys who are reading my website, but other players and people around the game and things like that. And Twitter's really helped me sort of gain these relationships with players, with readers, with people like that. And I think I just kind of realized that, like, I could do this as a way to get involved and get inside the game and sort of, and I've been able to do that.
Twitter's an incredible platform, especially from a sports standpoint, and that must have really helped you, especially running an independent site, where I started my own site when I first got started, but throughout the years, I've kind of been working on other people's site. But running your own site, there has to be a lot of challenges with that, and especially establishing your credibility as a legitimate baseball reporter, what are some of the challenges you've run into running your own site?
Well, I mean, obviously nobody's ever heard of CoverThoseBases.com. I'm not writing for Fox Sports. I'm not writing for ESPN. So it takes a lot more than just the name brand that gives you the credibility, like you said. But I honestly really love doing my own thing. I'm allowed to play with the design. I can do what I want, write what I want. Nobody's really telling me what to do. And now that I have sort of built up this credibility, those challenges have been a little bit alleviated since. And I honestly just love writing for my own site.
It's a great platform, and like I said, if you've never visited it, CoverThoseBases.com. There's a ton of incredible content up there driven by Devin himself. You worked on another platform with Robert Murray, MLBDailyRumors.com. What pushed you towards working on that platform? And especially I thought more interesting was what drove you to continue working on your own solo platform, because I thought it was important, especially where you're not writing for that dual platform anymore.
Yeah, what happened was a couple years ago, I started writing at like Sports Rumor Alert with Robert, and over time, he decided to sort of branch off from there and start his own website, sort of see how that would work, and we kind of did that together, and unfortunately, it just didn't really work out. It just never really picked up off the ground, and he decided he wanted to go to an established site, and you know, I respect that, but I went back to Cover Those Bases. I never really stopped during that time. It's just I continue to do what I love to do on my own website, and I'm just really happy that I've been able to do what I want there.
One of those defining moments, I thought, MLB Daily Rumors was, of course, the Billy Butler breaking news. You don't want to get too much into the sources that drove you to breaking that story, but what was kind of that week like working with Robert Murray, and did you go into that off season on a mission to break a story, or were you stunned that you ran into that information without going into too much detail of how you got it?
Yeah, I'd honestly call it a stunner. I really didn't go into that off season, you know, really with any expectation. I just kind of wanted to continue to grow, and I just kind of came across that information with someone I know around the game, and you know, I wasn't really sure if it was true, but I mean I trusted who told me this. I felt like he really had a lot of credibility in terms of that sense, and so I just tweeted it out, and I really hoped that it would have got confirmed, and after a couple of days there's really no word on that. And I send a DM to Ken Rosenthal. Well, I first send a tweet. I'm like, hey, Ken, can I DM you? And he's like, sure. And on the DM, I'm just like, Ken, I got this story. I really don't know what to do with it. It's gotten some recognition, but I have no idea if it's true. And he says, well, if it is true, do you want some credibility? You know, I'll give you credit for it, but that's only if it's true. And I said, that'd be great. You know, that'd be awesome. Thank you. And obviously it came out to be true. And then Robert Murray tweeted the actual agreement. He got the actual agreement done. And obviously it was a really hectic week. It was so much fun. It was so much publicity, really, when I was just relaying what I heard. And it was absolutely the most fun week I've had doing this. I can't trade that in for anything else. It was just a great memory and something that I really loved happening to me.
It's an unbelievable story. You know, appeared on the NY Post. You got to do an interview on NPR. I see MLB Network, and I see you honored the achievement to your grandfather.
Yeah, it's especially because, you know, I started this whole website, you know, because of him. I just feel like, you know, unfortunately, he never got to see it, but at the same time, I know that he's still there reading it out there somewhere. You know, it's really just a pleasure I really have writing about baseball, and all I know is I'm just talking to him. That's basically what it all comes down to, what it's all simplified to. I'm telling him what's going on, you know. You know, the Rockies just released Jose Reyes. You know that? Stuff like that.
I love that story, Devin, and it must have been really cool to hear from some of your idols on it. Ken Rosenthal, you got to appear on MLB Network. Was there anyone else you heard from who kind of pat you on the back, gave you some congratulations that you've looked up to coming up through the years?
Absolutely, Ken Rosenthal. He's just an absolute professional. I love how he's just an excellent writer. He's an excellent reporter, excellent on TV. And I've watched all numerous MLB on Fox games. I've watched the All-Star game every year, things like that. And, you know, he's always on there sharing what he's got from his sources. And he was obviously the number one. He's amazing. He's a great guy. And I love watching him report and do his thing because there's really no one out there like him. He really hits hard on those long stories, those long profiles, and does great with his reporting and really just gives you the information first. And I think when I was able to come in contact with him, I was definitely starstruck.
And I think it says a lot about his character, too, that instead of just, you know, running with the story that you kind of picked up, he took the time to talk to you, give you that credit. A lot of people wouldn't do that, I think. I think that says a lot about him. So you got to appear on MLB Network. I want to talk a little bit about that. What was that day like? Was there nerves? When did you first hear you were going on? It was the Hot Stove show, right?
Yeah, it was the night before I found out I was going on, but the one complication was I was going on at 11 a.m., and at 11 a.m., I'm in school. I was in fourth period. What am I going to do? How am I going to go on MLB Network, right? So what ended up happening was my mom pulled me out of school that day at 11 for the interview. I got in the car. We drove into the back of the parking lot where there was nobody there. And I called MLB Network from my middle school parking lot.
Did you go to school after, or was that the end of the day for you?
Yeah, I went back to school. My face was burning. I was like, I don't know what I just did, but I'm pretty sure I just loved it.
Did you get to see – you obviously got to see it on video later, right?
Yeah.
It's a very, very cool moment, and the grind never stops right back in school a few hours later, so – moving to the baseball landscape right now, I kind of teased in the little introduction there, but the people love to point out some of the widely stated issues with baseball, pace of play, less kids playing for some of the other sports, but the MLB itself continues to drive widespread interest, whether it's TV ratings, the playoffs, the deals, the advertisements. I think the TV deals especially point to just how powerful of a hold MLB has in the professional sports landscape here in America. What do you think has specifically allowed it to remain such a powerhouse, even for some of its problems?
I think one thing that makes Major League Baseball different than any other sport is it's a team sport. You have LeBron James on your team in the NBA, you're to make playoffs every single year. You have Bryce Harper on your team, you have Mike Trout on your team, you might still not make the playoffs. And when we get to the playoffs, we get to see these teams that have just outstanding chemistry. Do you really think that the Cavs had the best chemistry in the NBA last year?
Yeah, of course not. There's some big problems with Kevin Love and stuff like that. It's a great point.
But let me ask you, do you think the Royals had the best chemistry in Major League Baseball last year?
They were definitely up there.
I would agree, and I think when we get to the playoffs, that's how it's been able to remain a powerhouse, is these stories of maybe the Royals didn't have the best player in the league, maybe not even their second best player, Lorenzo Cain, top 15 guy, maybe Alex Gordon in there, but they didn't really have a top guy, but it was that they were a team, and that's what makes baseball so much different than the rest of the sports.
And continuing with that NBA-MLB parallel right there, you see a team like the Celtics, scrappy, young, talented, maybe not as talented as some of the top-tier teams, but they fight to the very end, and all they get out of is a first-round exit. And you saw with the 2013 Red Sox, people were predicting them talent-wise to finish in last place, but the chemistry came together. You got young guys like Daniel Nava, veterans like Shane Victorino stepping up in the big moment, and a team a lot of people in last place won the whole thing, so it's a great point right there. So, you know, that's what makes the MLB strong, I think, but there are some issues with the sport, some issues that baseball has to tackle. What do you think is the biggest issue?
I honestly think the biggest issue with Major League Baseball is marketing its superstars. I think even a lot of casual fans might not even know who Paul Goldschmidt is. And Paul Goldschmidt might even win the National League MVP this year. And I think really what they have to do, and it's hard for baseball. I mean, you're not going to be able to Paul Goldschmidt might go over four with three strikeouts one day, whereas in football or basketball, Aaron Rodgers is going to throw his three touchdowns week in, week out. He has to. And Major League Baseball has to find a way to market its biggest stars, which is why I think I've been thinking about this, and I really think that they should implement sort of a flex scheduling like the NFL does. Something that National Football League does is if there's a divisional game at the end of the season that could determine who the division champion is, they flip that to Sunday night. Well, baseball, if Clayton Kershaw is pitching against Steven Strasburg on Sunday, why don't you make that the Sunday night baseball game? Why don't you implement that strategy and get more people watching that game? And I think there are certain things. I think a day World Series game, games that don't start at 8 p.m., games that start at maybe 1 in the afternoon, especially on those weekend days, I think that could be of interest, especially to the younger generation. I think there are definitely ways to tackle these issues that they have.
Do you think when it comes to targeting an audience, that younger generation is who the MLB should really be going after?
Absolutely, and it's going to be hard. Major League Baseball, it's a slow sport. I'm going to be the first one to admit it. It is slow. There's a lot of breaks in the action, and it's going to be hard to really make an appeal to these younger fans, which at the same time is why you got to need to market those big players. I live outside Washington, D.C. Bryce Harper rules this land. I mean, amongst all the kids, you see Bryce Harper T-shirt jerseys, you see Bryce Harper everything. And because Bryce Harper is such a household name, people go to Nats games to see, guess who? Bryce Harper. And I think that's what Major League Baseball needs to do. And unfortunately, not every team has this big superstar like Bryce Harper, but they need to find a way to make younger fans in other parts of the country, maybe where there's not a big star, like maybe the scrappy player, like in San Francisco. Maybe they, instead of liking Madison Bumgarner, they like Brandon Belts, who's an excellent hitter. Though he doesn't put up the power numbers, he's just an all-around great hitter.
It's a great point, and I'll build off that a little bit. And I think one of the issues that Major League Baseball has right now, it's going to improve over time, is that their superstars are so young. I mean, these guys are starting to come out in high school. It's taken them a while to get through the systems, and now you're seeing these young all-stars take over the all-star game, and they're starting to establish themselves as these superstars almost at the baseball level, but they don't have this national appeal like you saw with an Albert Pujols back in the day, Barry Bonds, Mark McGwire, some of those high-rated stars. So I think as far as pushing those players forward, it's going to take some time. And whether it's player movement or trades or something of the sort, there's got to be some that can boost these young guys. And I got to ask you, too, why do you think Major League Baseball seems to be becoming so youth-driven this decade?
Oh, I think it's a really a big copycat industry. And you've got teams that are seeing Carlos Correa come up in the middle of a pennant race last year and really deliver for the Houston Astros. And he was one of the main reasons they ended up winning that wild card spot and going into the American League Division Series. And the teams are being more aggressive with their younger, more talented players in the minor leagues, and they're bringing them up to the major leagues faster. And Indians did it with Francisco Lindor almost about the same time as the Astros did with Carlos Correa. And you're going to start to see, and I think this is going to be something that stays in baseball for many years to come, prospects that are drafted out of high school that are 18 may take as many years to come up to the major leagues as those drafted out of college. You could see them drafted out of college at age 21. They're up in the major leagues about age 24. And people say, well, if they're out of high school, it's going to take them about 5 years. They'll be up around 23. No, these guys are coming up at 21, 22. They're being put right into A-ball right out of high school. And, you know, sometimes they struggle. Sometimes they go right after it. And they're in AAA. They're in AA by the time they're like 20. And that's what's going to keep happening in Major League Baseball. And then we're going to see we're going to have another thing where we see the free agent market come back and be a big thing. Because Bryce Harper is going to be a free agent at 26. I'm not even sure he's going to be in his prime by then. So you're going to see this whole sort of shift in balance. Yeah, young players, but the younger they come up into the major leagues, the faster they get to free agency.
How do you view sabermetrics as a tool in baseball? It's led to championships for the teams that have had been able to back it up with money, but you know, the Oakland Athletics, who kind of spearheaded it, still haven't been able to make that next push. Has it become a little too widespread to actually be a weapon for small market teams in your eyes?
I think that's a good question, and I would say yes and no. I think there's got to be, you still have to have the talent in place. You know, no matter how good your sabermetrics are, especially with the rise of free agent contracts, you still have to have the talent out of the draft. The Royals are by no means a big market team, and they are able to use sabermetrics to sign guys like Ian Kennedy and stuff, because once they start winning, they get a little bit of an extra push money-wise, and they can go sign those free agents that maybe not be as highly regarded, but still will make a difference. Oakland, on the other hand, they don't have a good stadium. They really, their fan base, they struggle to draw sometimes. They really haven't won in a few years, and it's caused them to sort of lose that extra surplus of money that comes with winning. And with no real market deficiencies out there, and there always are market deficiencies, but there's always, you know, an evolution of what teams are looking for. The A's are a little bit of a step back, and it's going to take until they get that next nucleus of young talent out of the draft before they can really step it back up again.
How do you yourself mix sabermetrics in your writing? I see you going into the advanced stats a lot. A big thing with you is pitcher defense. You seem to really emphasize that. What are some of the most important stats? And on the other hand, what are some of the least relevant conventional stats in your eyes?
Some of the most important stats to me are OPS plus, weighted runs created plus. Those two right there, they take a player's, in the case of OPS plus per se, they take a player's OPS and they put it under, you know, a formula, and they turn it into and make it adjusted to park and league factors. So if a player's playing in a more hitter's ballpark, it will go down. If a player's playing in a more pitcher's ballpark, it will go up, assuming they have high OPSs. And it puts it on a scale of 100, 100 being league average, 101 being 1% above league average, 99 being 1% below league average. And I think that stat offensively looks at everything that a player has been able to do and makes it a very good comparison between, per se, a Coors Field player and a Petco Park player. And I think that's a great stat. Obviously, wins above replacement WAR, I love WAR. WAR, I think it's a fantastic stat. Problem with WAR, though, is there's many different ways to calculate it. I use FanGraphs version. I think it's a very fair way. They incorporate base running. They incorporate defense, but some incorporate defense more and some incorporate defense less. Some incorporate offense more. And you're never going to find the perfect formula, because you're never going to know what's more important, offense or defense. And are they equal? And if they're not equal, how far off are they? Probably the most irrelevant conventional stat is runs batted in. RBIs are worthless. They don't really tell you the story of a player in what name. I include them on my website for the more casual fan, but in all reality, RBI is a team stat. You hit a solo home run and your buddy next to you playing on the Boston Red Sox, the best offensive team in the major leagues, hits a grand slam. He gets 4 RBI, you get 1, but you both did the same thing. And honestly, RBI doesn't tell you anything about how good the player is. They could say it's good situational hitting, he hits with runners on base, things like that. But there's really no such thing as clutch. Really, there isn't. A lot of people would argue, yes, some players are more clutch than others. But no, there really isn't. And RBI is just an absolute worthless counting stat that really needs to be done away with.
I see you said also there's no such thing as clutch. Are you one of those people who, when it comes to utilizing relievers, don't see a difference between, say, the 7th inning, 8th inning, 9th inning? Do you think outs become harder to get as the game goes on and a sense of urgency increases from the other team? Or do you see maybe like a 2 base runner situation in the 8th inning as being worthy of putting your closer in there, say, like just starting the 9th up 1 run?
Yeah, absolutely. I think you use your highest leverage reliever in the highest leverage situation of the game, and that's going to get you the most wins, unless you are a team like the Yankees or the Royals, where you basically have like four closers on your team already. You're going to need to use that closer in a spot sometimes outside of their comfort zone in order to get the outs that you need, especially in the tough times. Closer coming in up one run in the ninth inning with the bases empty, yeah, that's pretty easy. But coming in, but if you have your eighth inning guy who's a far inferior reliever up one run, there's two runners on base, one out, something bad's going to happen, and it's probably going to cost you the game.
The sabermetrics people, especially, I always point to Oakland as being a center of sabermetrics mindset in baseball, and they've never placed a big emphasis on having a highly touted reliever. In fact, they swindled the Red Sox back in the day, trading Andrew Bailey here, who just never even made an impact on the Red Sox and eventually just got cast away on that 2013 team, for Josh Reddick, who's been a very productive player and continues to grow out there in Oakland. But on the other side, you saw the Royals come together and make a World Series run and then win a championship by just compiling these super arms at the end of their bullpen that were able to slam the door on games. And you've seen teams, like you said, it's a copycat league. The Yankees have tried to follow that platform, compiling several big arm relievers. The Red Sox themselves this year trade away big prospects for Craig Kimbrel. Is there a value in committing big money and prospects to highly touted relievers?
I think it depends on your starting pitching staff. I think if you're a team that has starters that go deeper into games, relief pitching isn't as important. But last year, especially with the Royals, outside of Johnny Cueto, who they got on July 31st, they had Edison Volquez, they had Chris Young. They had guys who, sure, could be very useful over five or six innings. And once they come out of a game, then you turn to your knockdown guys and Kelvin Herrera, Wade Davis, those types of guys. And it depends on where you're going to get what you're going to get out of your starters. And no matter who the starter is, it's been proven that a starter is good through two times through the order. But once they start facing that team for the third time, that's when they're going to start giving up those big hits, those runs. So if you can go through, if a starter can go through the lineup just twice and take you five and two-thirds, six innings, maybe slightly into that third time through the order, and you can put in these fresh arms that are throwing 97, 98, that's going to be very helpful.
We're talking baseball landscape here with Devin Fink, CoverThoseBases.com. We're learning a lot on the weekly tour here with Devin. It's been a fun conversation. So we're going to move on to another highly divisive topic in baseball, and it's PEDs. The MLB has come down hard on PEDs this decade, mostly because of public backlash, I would say myself. But back in the 90s, you know, the league didn't really put a finger on it. You can argue whether or not they really had an idea of what was going on under the surface, but there isn't a doubt that they didn't take action on it. So Barry Bonds, Mark McGwire, some of these guys with PED suspicion over their head. Should we remember these guys as great players? And more importantly, should they be Hall of Famers?
Well, Bobby, unfortunately, I never got to see any of these great guys play. With that said, however, I've done enough research since that time to really say this. I personally think that there's multiple arguments here, and I think that when you look at it, there's two arguments that really stand out to me. Number one, Major League Baseball didn't test for PEDs for the longest time. And number two, the Hall of Fame just can't ignore the PED era. It was an era. It was an era. Everyone was using the PEDs, and for the Hall of Fame just to completely wash that out of the history books, that's just absurd. You have to embrace what happened, and unfortunately, if there were issues with it, you fix those issues in the future, and you create more quote-unquote clean Hall of Famers in the future. But you can't take that away for Barry Bonds when he never served a PED suspension, when he never was caught using PEDs. I know the Balco report came out and all that stuff, but we never failed the test. And all those things aside, I would say yes, you have to put them in the Hall of Fame. And if you don't, you're missing a huge part of baseball history in there.
Yeah, I love that argument. I love that standpoint. And I even say it with a guy like Pete Rose, and it's a different situation, of course, but just ignoring that that career ever happened, even for all the things he did, and they were terrible things centered around the game of baseball, gambling as a player and a manager, as they now say, there's got to be some sort of recognition. And I don't know if you officially induct them. I don't know if you do it later just to make a point, but shadowing out an era of baseball history is completely against what I think the Hall of Fame should stand for. I think it's a memorial of different eras of baseball. Having them all in that same building is important. And frankly, especially with Barry Bonds and the home run race of the 90s, those were defining figures of an entire decade of baseball. And keeping
that brought them out of a strike, nonetheless. Yeah. That brought them out of a strike. It really brought back Major League Baseball from its lowest points, its darkest days.
And, you know, like you said, they've made amends. I think the Balco report was strictly serving to put baseball in the right direction rather than tear down some of its biggest stars back then as it did. So we'll move on from PEDs. I'm sure there'll be a lot of different reactions to that. And we'll move on to the MLB draft this year. Tons of high school arms coming out of the draft. A lot of youth, like we talked about early in the show. So many corners of America touched on it. But compared to the NFL draft and, of course, the NBA draft last night, which are national events, the MLB draft doesn't catch very much attention at all unless it's after the fact or regionally by team. What do you think baseball can do to push its draft to a bigger spotlight?
I honestly, the Major League Baseball draft will never be as big as the NFL or the NBA draft. Because of the fact that these players aren't impact players immediately. You draft a first-round quarterback in the NFL, you get Jared Goff, he's going to be starting for you week one. The MLB, you draft number one overall pick, Mickey Moniak, you might not see him for 4 or 5 years. So it will never be as big as those. But with that said, however, it was a little bit sad that only two draft prospects were actually there the night of the first-round draft. And when you see these NBA players, these NFL players at the draft that get called on draft night, that start crying, hugging their parents, things like that, that's the humility that those casual fans like. And the MLB draft, all it really is just a big press conference with the first pick, the Phillies select Mickey Moniak, a outfielder out of, you know, California, blah, blah, blah. And nobody cares. You see video of him on MLB Network. No, nobody really cares, right? I mean, he's not going to be in the major leagues for 4 or 5 years. But if Mickey Moniak was at the draft, he was crying, hugging his parents, getting to put on the Phillies hat, the Phillies jersey, and going up there shaking Rob Manfred's hand and putting his name up on the wall, I think that definitely draws more appeal. And you argue that, you know, they've got the problems with the College World Series. Those players in college can't go to the draft. And I get that. And there's multiple solutions. You could move it to Omaha, Nebraska, which is where the College World Series is being played anyway, make the draft later in the year, but that would cause problems in terms of getting these guys right into pro ball, or just try and get more of the high schoolers to come. But only when only two prospects come, that's a problem.
I also find the timing of the MLB draft strange. I mean, the NFL and NBA put their draft right in the dead spot in their calendars just to kind of drum up excitement, but the MLB, their draft is right in the middle of the season. And do you think that could be a factor in why not many of the players end up showing out for the draft?
It could, but the reason MLB draft is in June is because it correlates with the end of the college and high school seasons to get these guys into pro ball as fast as possible and get them to the major leagues ultimately as fast as possible. And I think moving it to the offseason, sure, that might create more appeal, but I don't think it'll have the same impacts in terms of later down the line when these guys are coming up to the major leagues. They didn't get that first half season of pro ball in, and I think that definitely does go a long way.
Speaking with some of the other changes we've seen in baseball of late, has replay been effective in baseball? We've had it for about 2 years now, almost 2 years. And if not, what would you change about it?
I think replay has been very effective. And honestly, I'm all for getting the call correct. I remember watching a few years ago, or actually more than a few years ago, I think this was maybe 2009 or 2010, Armando Galarraga, the imperfect game. He got 27 outs in a row. He did get that last out, but Jim Joyce, I still know that name. I mean, I just could not believe what I was watching. Jim Joyce blew the game at first base. And I think ever since that moment, and ever since replay was instituted for instances like that, I think, yes, it's been effective. It gets the call right. And if that ever happens again, the umpires can make it a review themselves, because that was a very close play. And yes, that would be fixed in the future. What I would change, however, is the amount of time it takes. Major League Baseball is all about, you know, speeding the game up. And I think there needs to be a time limit on these replays. I think if you cannot determine that the call needs to, that the call should be turned after X number of minutes, the call just stands as initially called on the field. And you should not have these 5-8 minute replays to only say, yeah, the guy was out, or yeah, the guy was safe. After 2 minutes, if there's not enough evidence to overturn the call, then you leave it as the way it was on the field.
We've had a lot of fun with Devin Fink here. We'll move into some of the final points with him before we send him on his way from the tour here. But I got to ask you about some more of your personal experiences. You've done interviews. You've done countless stories throughout the years. Who would you say is the most interesting person you've talked to covering baseball?
Gosh, that's a good question. Honestly, I think it was the most recent interview I did comes to mind immediately. I interviewed a Cleveland Indians prospect by the name of Ben Heller, and he's really the epitome of hard work and putting in all the maximum effort and getting your reward. Ben Heller, he was picked in the 22nd round of the MLB draft. He was picked in the 650th overall. Nobody knew about him. He signed for a $2,000 signing bonus. When guys today are signing for over $6 million, he signed for $2,000, and he was throwing low 90s. That's good for a person in general, but not good for a professional baseball player. And he just put the work in, not to get drafted, but after getting his foot in the door, he put the work in to make himself a shutdown reliever. Ben Heller now throws 100 miles an hour, and he's going to be in the major leagues this season. And he just shared an excellent story. I mean, it was so heartwarming. Grew up in rural Wisconsin and, you know, playing baseball with his brothers, taking batting cage in their basement during the winter. Like, just he just really did a fantastic job really giving me his story, the way he got to where he is today. And I honestly think he's one of the most interesting people that I've ever talked to. Just a fantastic guy. So you should definitely check that out.
That is available up at coverthosebases.com, right?
Yes.
Another question on your baseball experiences over the years. Baseball, good for the bloopers, good for the strange moments. What's the strangest moment you've ever seen watching baseball?
Honestly, I've seen a lot of strange stuff. I always like to go to when I go to a game, I always kind of want to see something different. And I'm going to just tell you my strangest experience I've ever seen going to a game. And I can't remember who the hitter was, but I think it was Jimmy Rollins, and he hit a ball to right field, and Bryce Harper just crashes into the right field wall. The ball's on the ground, rolling towards center field, and Jimmy Rollins, I may have not even been Rollins, I don't even remember who, but it was an inside the park home run. I'm like, those are pretty rare in general, and the fact that I got to see it in such a weird way, the ball, I can't even remember if it hit off Harper's glove or what, but he smashed in the wall, and the ball just goes shooting right off into center field. And Rollins, I'm pretty sure, got in standing up. And I'm just like, wow, that's got to be one of the strangest things I've ever seen.
I think I do remember that, some with the angle of the ballpark, and that's a big thing, too, with baseball. These ballparks are also individually unique, so every stadium's different. Every home field advantage is different. Baseball truly is just a unique sport. I say my funnest moment, especially over the last few years, the Bartolo Colon experience. In what other sport Do you see a guy deep into his 40s, big bulging stomach, he must be 300 pounds, and he's up there for the Mets just dominating. And, you know, he doesn't put up the best stats. He's not the most consistent performer. But the fact that a guy like that just comes out and strikes people out and goes 7-8 innings and puts in these great starts for the Mets and then gets up to the bat, you never see pitchers, you rarely see pitchers do anything from the plate. And here's this guy who one at bat swings and his helmet falls off and he's looking like a fool up there. And then he comes back months later and hits a home run to left field.
And that the thing is that home run broke James Shields.
The Bartolo Colon experience. You hope it never ends. So before we send you packing, Devin, I got to ask you, what do you want to achieve in sports media in the future? I know you want to be a baseball reporter, but what specific impacts do you want to make on the sports media field?
I think really it needs to become more of a sabermetric-centered field. And that's the way that teams are going, and that's the way that really I feel like the media should go as well. And it's hard to educate fans, especially, you know, casual fans on these intricate stats. But I think when you really look at it, you can find some really interesting things. It really tells you who's underrated, who's overrated. And guys like Ryan Spader, the guy who runs the Ace of MLB stats account, when he does stuff like that to bring these stats to the public eye, to the public interest, he's got 40,000 followers on Twitter. He's a fantastic follow if you're not following him already. When these things are brought to the fans, it just makes it really a bigger educated fan base. And when you've got an educated fan base, you've got a fan base that's going to stay for a very long time.
That's Devin Fink. He's always educating the fan base. You can follow him on Twitter at Devin Fink, and you can read his fantastic pieces at coverthosebases.com. We appreciate you being on the tour. Very informative appearance, Devin. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Bobby. I had a ton of fun.
That's Devin Fink, our third guest on the Bobcast. We keep rolling here. We're going to get you out of here in just a few minutes. But first, as always, we like to hit on some of the big, important topics in sports and pop culture. And today, no other way to get around it. We have to hit on the NBA draft. And without going into the specifics on the Celtics, as you know, I write at CelticsBlog.com. You'll be reading many of my pieces on the draft over the next few days, next few weeks. So I'll point you in that direction if you're looking for some Celtics takes. As far as the NBA landscape goes, and we've hit a lot on the NBA and MLB landscapes today, the NBA has truly gone international, and we've known that for quite some time, but I feel like the 2016 NBA draft was really a coming out party for the international basketball scene. Breaking it down by the numbers, 15 international picks out of the 60 prospects selected. That's a pretty fair percentage of guys who are playing overseas rather than in college basketball where players are traditionally picked from. 28 players of foreign origin. That's almost half the entire draft coming from countries other than America, the home of basketball. Where basketball started, where basketball grew. Now you're seeing 21 countries represented in the NBA draft, including the USA. Egypt, China, France, the Ukraine, Ghana, Nigeria, Germany, Mali, Croatia, Serbia, Haiti, Cameroon, Spain, Greece, Lithuania, Austria, Australia, South Sudan, the Bahamas, Canada. That's truly touching every corner of the globe, and it's incredible. And you got to give credit. This isn't just an accident. This was the NBA itself reaching out across the world, appealing to an international market, putting on games in other places, having these superstars who have such global appeal. I mean, you have people in Kobe Bryant jerseys in China. I'm sure there's Steph Curry jerseys throughout Europe. People grow up around the world and look up to the NBA, and you truly don't see that at any other level, any other professional sport than the NBA. The MLB has some international appeal between Cuba and Latin America. Football, forget about it. That's strictly an American sport. Hockey, I'd say it draws closest. You have a very strong hold in Europe, Canada, mostly the more northern regions, of course. But basketball, when you have players coming from China and Egypt and Africa, it's an incredible collection of international names last night, and it adds to the uncertainty of the NBA draft. There's no way around that. The Celtics took two international players in the first round. You don't even know if they're ever going to make an impact on this team. Between eight picks, the Celtics had to work out over 100 players. You can't just look at college basketball anymore and hope to get your talent from that. You have to look around the world. You have to look to China. You have to look to Croatia. You have to look to all these different places. And you can't hold a bias against these players anymore from the international ranks, because then you get hit in the face with a guy like Kristaps Porzingis, who's going to be a superstar in the NBA for years to come. If you snub your nose at Kristaps Porzingis, like the Knicks could have, they'd be paying the price. And of course they got booed. Of course, Yabusele and Zizek got booed by the Celtics fans last night. I was frustrated myself, but we don't know enough about these guys. Just because they come from Yabusele in France and Zizek in Croatia doesn't mean they have, or doesn't mean they don't have as much potential as a guy out of Kentucky or a guy out of Maryland. And maybe the competition's more intense in these college level games than in the Europe leagues. But it doesn't mean that individual talents can't stand out, and you saw a lot of individual talents stand out last night. And what added to the historic nature of this draft is the NBA so long opposed to letting players come out of high school. Even though the one and done, it's basically the same thing. You saw a guy like Anthony Davis who could have easily come out of high school and been drafted number one overall, spend his year at Kentucky, dominate that scene, and then go number one anyway. And you saw a guy like Nerlens Noel, who probably didn't need college. He spent a year there, injured his knee, and saw his draft stock fall. And who knows how that affected his NBA career when it's all said and done. But Thon Maker, Canadian high school prospect, escaped South Sudan, an incredible story. Not many people thought the NBA would allow him to come after graduating high school, but I guess the period was long enough where they said, come on in, Thon, and he's drafted 10th overall by the Milwaukee Bucks last night, adding to that incredible youth movement that the NBA draft has seen. You're seeing 18, 19-year-olds. 18 is probably the minimum you're going to see with some of the NBA's restrictions, but when it comes to the NBA, I say keep these doors open. Sooner or later, people are going to learn to love the international players, especially as they start making impacts on these teams. The same Celtics fans who booed Zizek and who cleared out of that Celtics draft party. And I'll admit it, I was one of them. I'm skeptical about these guys. I'm skeptical about the picks. I thought they were reaches, especially Yabusele. But man, if they come to the Celtics and help lead them to that championship, you best believe there's going to be French flags flying around the stadium or Croatia flags. And I even say, open it up to the high school prospects. The NCAA obviously has stake in it, and they want to have March Madness be a hit with some top-tier players. But if you don't need it, you don't need it. There's no point in trying to stand behind this guise of the college athlete. Everybody knows what goes on behind the scenes in those college programs. I don't think many people are fooled by the notion that they're college athletes. Student athletes is the buzz term they use. if you're talented enough to go to the NBA right out of high school graduation, you deserve to go. You shouldn't be held to restrictions. You shouldn't have to, quote unquote, waste your time at a college that may just not do very much for you, as you saw with an Anthony Davis. Flipping the script to the NHL. Bobby Manning talking about hockey. Believe it. The NHL, to use a pun, gambling on Las Vegas. And I say it could be a grand slam for the sport. This is via the Associated Press. The Vegas franchise is expected to begin playing the 2017-18 season. Yes, the NHL has a franchise in Las Vegas, Nevada. The notorious land where no professional sports team wanted to touch for so many years is now open for business. From the story, the Vegas franchise is expected to begin playing the 2017-18 season, which is the earliest the league could expand, according to a third-party person who has been briefed on the situation. The franchise would be the NHL's 31st team and the first major professional sports franchise in Las Vegas, the rapidly growing gambling center of the American West. The NHL hasn't expanded since 2000, when Minnesota and Columbus paid $80 million each to join the league. Prospective Vegas owner Bill Foley is a wealthy businessman who isn't likely to blink at the elevated price tag previously proposed by NHL Commissioner Gary Bettman as an expansion fee. The Las Vegas bid says it has secured more than 14,000 season ticket deposits for the new team, which will play in the T-Mobile Arena. The sparkling new multi-purpose building on the south end of the Las Vegas Strip. The arena, which seats 17,500 for hockey, was built entirely with private money by MGM Resorts International and Anschutz Entertainment Group. Now, I'll say this. In a sport as random, full of parody, and as competitive as the NHL, where you see two teams in the San Jose Sharks and Pittsburgh Penguins rise from the middle of the pack to the Stanley Cup Final, when you see a team like the Chicago Blackhawks tear through the playoffs last year and win their third championship in 5 years, come back with a fully loaded squad this year, dominate the regular season, and then get matched up with another talented team in the St. Louis Blues first round and get knocked out. That's the kind of league the NHL is. Hockey's a wild game to begin with, and they are the right league to take a gamble on Las Vegas. They have their issues, as noted in the story. The Phoenix Coyotes, as this new franchise is beginning, is struggling to make money, is owned by the league itself, and has been unable to find an owner or a level of support to become a fully functioning NHL franchise. But even they have had a playoff appearance in the past few years. Now, expansion teams are tricky business. You're going to have an expansion draft. The talent that the Las Vegas team takes on this first year initially won't be great. They very well could be the worst team in the NHL in the 2017-18 season when they're expected to begin. But over time, and we've seen it in the NHL, that franchise could out of nowhere, the Tampa Bay Lightning the last few years, rise to the top of the league. It's not a very hard thing to do. Make some smart decisions. See some other teams locked up in bad contracts in a hard cap league. And the Las Vegas, whatever, could be champions in 2020. And I'll tell you from a Boston standpoint, nothing is more exciting than a good hockey team. Nothing is exciting as watching that hockey team tear through the madness that is the NHL playoffs. It's as exciting as it gets. My whole entire city, Peabody, Massachusetts, there's some hardcore sports fans, there's some casual sports fans, but I'll tell you, the entire or nearly the entire city who had any interest in sports rallied around those great Bruins teams that won the championship in 2011 and made a Stanley Cup run in the wake of the Boston Marathon bombing in 2013. Those were likable teams, tough teams, and the run was incredible. Some classic games throughout my childhood. And that's what you could be seeing through Las Vegas. When it gets cold, the team that is never gets cold in Las Vegas from a weather standpoint. It's tough. The Bruins are losing their luster right now through some tough decisions, two missed playoff appearances. The interest isn't there, and I'd argue they've fallen to the bottom of the four teams in the city again. But when they're good, you're going to see Las Vegas as a city rally around that team. And Las Vegas is a toss-up. It's a walk-through city. It's a vacation destination. They're going to try to appeal the vacationers with tickets. I'm sure the casinos are going to buy the luxury boxes. That's not important. Those fans don't matter. You don't want to have a stopgap team like Atlanta, where sure, there's some local support, but Atlanta's more of a walk-through city. You're going to land there to hop on your flight to another flight and leave. You're going to stay there on business. You're not going to go watch the Atlanta Hawks, the Atlanta Thrashers, who moved to Winnipeg in the NHL. Couldn't even survive there. So we'll see. The Las Vegas community seems excited about it. It's not official yet, so the government there didn't make too many official comments on it, but they did seem excited when approached for comments. I think Las Vegas is going to be a worthwhile experience for the NHL, and my main take is that they were the right league to do it. Before we go, I want to hit on a comment by T. Murph on Twitter, one of my main men on there, one of my favorite followers. He suggested a wage sliding scale for NBA players coming out of the draft to try to appeal to players who stay longer, try to keep them there longer, have them improve their game at the college level, keep the college game competitive. My problem with that, just as teams take younger prospects for their upside now, the increased money on those four-year starters in college would probably make teams turn their heads even more away from those older players at the college level. You saw it last night. Teams are willing to go all in on potential rather than sure things. Bryce Johnson, a pretty solid product out of North Carolina, didn't go until the late 20s. Meanwhile, the Celtics use a 16th pick on a relative unknown out of France. Potential is the name of the game in the NBA draft. And even though it would be cool to see players stay in college longer, the sliding scale would not be very effective. Sorry, T. Murph. Love the idea. I'm going to shoot that one down on you. And that's where we'll leave it this week. An incredible conversation with Devin Fink. Please subscribe to us on iTunes. We're going to have more incredible guests like that. We're going to cover more incredible stories. Tell us what you want to see on this program. This is your show as much as it is my show. I appreciate the support. The first episode with Adam did fantastic. The second one with Snotty last week, who I'll give credit for being right about the finals, did sensational. And hopefully you'll continue to stick with us. Give me your feedback at RealBobManning on Twitter. For some Celtics draft analysis, CelticsBlog.com is the spot to go. And please subscribe and rate to the Bobcast on iTunes. The link is over on the show's Twitter account, which you should follow as well, at The Bobcast Show. That's been the tour for the week. We bring aboard one of my most influential mentors as a young rising sports media member, Tony Capobianco. He's currently working in the Oklahoma City area, so he'll have plenty of insight as NBA free agency begins and Kevin Durant mania blows off. Thank you for joining the weekly tour, the Bobcast, a weekly tour of sports and pop culture. We'll see you next week. Thanks for hopping aboard.